Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined again today by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project, here on a crisp but pleasant fall morning.
Beautiful, pleasant fall morning on the campus here.
Yeah, you know, got our friend... personal friend and, you know, some degree friend of the pod and one of the, you know, Texas podcast originators, Reeve Hamilton, was in town last night, you know, and Reeve is living in Ithaca and was, you know, I thought he was going to sort of, you know,
poo-poo
put
us.
Some shorts on.
Yeah, right.
You know, he said, yeah, the high was when he was leaving Ithaca, the forecast was a high of 30. So as we break out our fall jackets and stuff in Austin, it's good to remember what, you know, much of the rest of the world.
I like to think that outside of this, I'm probably most known for my layering. A lot of layers.
Well, there you go. I'm thinking about that. Okay. So we're thinking this is going to be the last podcast of the year, maybe, you know, a little early, but on the academic calendar to end the podcast
preview
for the year. But, you know, we still have some stuff to do. And what we thought we'd, you know, and it sort of fits classes winding up at UT Austin is we mentioned from time to time during the last several months, really most of the last year, but certainly the last 6 or 7 months. You know, we've been working together and spending a lot of time focused on launching a new online U.S. and Texas politics intro course that, I don't know, we were assigned, we embraced, a little of both.
I love the opportunity to teach young minds.
There you go. And it's you know, as we've said, it's been an interesting experience.
Yes.
One upshot of this, though, is that, you know, we spent less time mining polling results in a public forum in the various ways that we've done for most of the time we've worked on the poll together for the last decade or so, you know, almost 2 decades for the entire life of the poll, as it turns out. So, you know, we're going to try to do a couple things today, but I don't know if you want to say anything about that experience and, you know, we've talked about it. I think the experience of thinking things through for the class, and we've kind of mentioned this here and there, you know, have seeped into the podcast and how we're thinking about this, even as it's come at opportunity costs for, you know, how we spent a lot of the previous several years and the rhythm and, you know, where we sort of put our energy and thinking and things like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm not, you know, whatever, the work is done, I don't care. It was hard and we're through that, the big, hard, heavy lift of starting the thing. But, you know, when you set that aside, and I should say, you know, we joke about it, and I think, you know, you probably agree with me, this is something that feels important. It's useful to sort of, you know, in the way that we approach the course to try to prepare students to at least engage, you know, with the public world in a way so that, you know, they're not confused by it. They're not totally just like, they don't throw their hands up and say, we can't do, like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
And so I feel really, you know, I feel pretty good about that. It's easy to get up and kind of do that work. You know, on the other hand, you know, just for me personally, you know, let's get to what really, for me, you know, it has been a really good chance to, you know, I always think about levels of conceptualization, which is a fancy way of sort of thinking about altitude. Like what's the distance at which you're looking at these different things? And, you know, we get an opportunity in our job to really, move in and out of different distances, apertures, whatever you want to, whatever analogy you want to use to kind of look at a lot of different concepts and phenomena, and we get the chance to think about it, and that's really fortunate. And in some sense, you know, I think what this doing the course at least allowed me to do is sort of go back to some of these kind of big picture questions. I mean, I've done a lot of reading about, you know, the founding and a lot of that kind of, you know, Revolutionary War history. What were they thinking about when they were creating the Constitution? What were the issues? And stuff that we've all, you know, embraced at various points over time. But to sort of do it again and without getting too much detail right now in this moment and to be able to kind of take a step back and look at stuff on either a longer time horizon or across multiple institutions and just thinking about it that way because we're nerds like that has been actually in some ways, one, really interesting, but two, in some ways, I think for the people out there who get really worked up about, you know, a lot of the stuff, which a lot of you all probably do, it almost allows you to kind of take a step back in a really way that in some ways makes, you know, dealing with the high volume of the politics going on right now a little bit easier, at least for me, because I'm looking at it in different lenses, different perspectives, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's something that the course has kind of allowed me to do, maybe a little better.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that. I've had some of that experience. I mean, I think, you know, as you and I have talked about offline, you know, I taught a version of this, you know, the intro, you know, essentially freshman government course, you know, a lot earlier in my career, you know, I mean, it, you know, in different places, some in Texas, but, you know, some in other places, Louisiana more specifically, and had not done it in a while. And, you know, the experience of going back and reviewing older sets of notes and, you know, you're thinking about things that, you know, the specific aspects of this or, you know, some specific and some different domains, mm-hmm. you just hadn't really thought about
a lot
other than for very practical, you know, immediate purposes right in front of you. I mean, not that we don't sit around and muse about the big picture or whatever, but, you know, it was very interesting. I was thinking about this morning, a concrete example.
Yeah.
You know, when I first taught this class, some, you know, in an interval measured in decades.
Yeah, you don't need to be that specific. It's an estimate.
You know, I mean, you know, just a very small thing, but I, you know, reading, I think, of the Politico playbook this morning and looking at the use of discharge petitions in the Congress, I mean, the kind of default discussion of discharge positions when I was started my career, such as it is teaching, you know, was like, this hardly ever happens.
Right.
And, you know, the big news this morning is like, you know, there's four or five discharge petitions floating around right now in the Congress. So, you know, that's a small, you know, not the most significant necessarily example of just, you know, how much some of the fundamentals that I would think of as both kind of social trajectory and institutional trajectory, generally speaking, are really different right now.
Yeah.
And have changed in the decade or so or 15 years or so that I didn't teach in, you know, the intro to government class and didn't have to sit and kind of lay all this stuff out.
Right.
And so it's been very, very interesting in that regard. But
Definitely a lot of food for thought. I mean, honestly, and it's definitely, and I say, you know, and I say, it's not even like, and I can say even right now, it's like the impact of having gone through this is probably pretty durable. It's probably not temporary. And, you know, that's what's sort of an interesting thing for us, because obviously, you know, you don't get a lot of opportunities for those kinds of shifts and sort of thinking and stuff, I think, very often. So
yeah, and I think that was, you know, that was a function of, you know, sort of our day-to-day and the, you know, the way that, you know, the job had evolved for us. I mean, it was a lot of, as you were saying, kind of, you know, not like, I mean, I think part of our brand is a little bit of a way of stepping back and contextualizing things. But it was good for invigorating that and making that better, ultimately,
I'd
like to think, anyway. I mean, if you listen to this, you can be the judge.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're like, if you're still listening.
You know, if you haven't just checked out.
All right.
So with all this going on, with that out there, you know, it seemed like a good focus for our last pod of the year to do kind of a listy year-ender. And frankly, as we've gotten ready for this, it's changed a little bit.
But
you know, go back and maybe hit on a few nuggets of data that we didn't really get a chance to push out there very, very effectively or in much volume or at all. And then to, you know, some of the data points that capture some of these bigger things that were unfolding in the world that were reflected in the data that we collected over the last year. You know, and in some cases, some of this, I think, as is naturally going to be the case, I think, especially if we do this right, that, you know, it's these things set up with what may be coming in 2026 as we begin to anticipate, which, you know, is likely to be, you know, yet another pretty important and eventful election nationally and in the state, since we have statewide elections. Okay, so let's start off. So why don't you start us off with a result that we didn't get a chance to talk to about much that you kind of noticed as we went back over this. And I should say, as we were prepping for this, you know, part of this just mechanically was, I'm pretty sure we both did this more or less the same way. Just going back and kind of, you know, I spent some time over the last couple of days. But hey, let's go back and look at every poll we did this year and just kind of flip through the summaries and flip through the write-ups and kind of see what was there. And it,
yeah,
was, it was also a good exercise, not unlike the class thing.
Yeah, no, it was. It was good.
On a smaller scale.
No, it's, I mean, you know, it is funny and all this. Of all the things we do, we're always looking, I mean, it's public opinion naturally. You're always looking ahead to the next thing in some ways. And we don't necessarily get too caught up in this per se because we have a little bit of a broader mandate, I guess, or whatever. But I mean, there is a sense of always about recency and how recent the data is and what it tells you. And so there's very little incentive a lot of times to go and look back unless you're like an academic working on some project, right? And so in this sense, you know, normally, you know, we are still working on the next poll, don't worry. But it's also like take the time to look back in December is actually really kind of fun and interesting, actually. So what's the thing that stuck out to me, you know, is going through all this and thinking about a combination of what was in the polling and what was going on, you know, sort of that spurred it. You know, one of the things that really stuck out to me was vaccines. You know, it's already been over 2.5 years since the WHO said, you know, declared the COVID-19 pandemic over. But we know from our own polling that for many, many people, especially here in Texas, you know, the pandemic ended long before that. And along, you know, the trajectory of that, vaccines became, you know, a significantly more important topic in a lot of people's lives than they had been up to that point. You know, if we go look at regular vaccination rates for things like the flu and stuff like that, right? So since then, you know, this issue, those, you know, sort of beliefs about the safety and effectiveness and overall wisdom of requiring vaccines hasn't really subsided, right? We have the nomination of noted vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead Health and Human Services. We have the outbreak of measles this summer in West Texas with nearly 800, cases confirmed over the first half of the year, right? And so, you know, and in the face of all this, the legislature's response is actually to pass a law to make it easier for parents and students to use reasons of conscience to opt students out of vaccine requirements at school. And now, while this has been going on, we have reporting that shows that the number of these exemptions has like more than doubled since 2018. So this is like, just to say, like, this is a big contextual space. And I think is, you know, I think there's a lot of stuff that we do where sometimes it almost feels like, you know, we just, I'm trying to think what the right word is. It's sort of being forced in some ways to do something based on, you know, sort of elite discussions, where the politics are going. This is something that I think we both agree just feels like important to just check in on sometimes, yeah, to see where people are at, just so we kind of know, you know, from like a public health and, you know, and political standpoint. And what we found this year was like a pretty drastic change, really, in some of these attitudes, especially if you know anything about herd immunity. So we've been asking this question about whether or not basically the state should require parents to have their children vaccinated against common, you know, childhood, you know, viruses, things like mumps, measles, rubella, things like that. And, you know, for much of the time series of the poll, going back 10 years, actually, on this question, we usually have about 3/4 of voters saying, yeah, the state, you know, we should require parents to do this. That makes sense. And usually the share saying no was around, you know, 14 to 15% with about 10% saying they just didn't know. And then when we asked it again this year, at the end of the year, in October 2025, it went from, again, about 75% in February of 2015. So we go jump ahead 10 years. It's 65% today. So it's dropped 10 points. The share of Texans to say it should not is 22%. So almost 1 in 4, really largely unchanged among independents and Democrats. Not surprisingly, given the politics of this, where we see that really it's among Republicans who we see the big, you know, increase in reticence. So we see, you know, 70% of Republicans in 2015 thought that, yeah, the state should require this. Today, it's 50%.
Yeah, that's a huge mind-blowing number to me. I mean, in terms of just the extent of that change.
And it's interesting, you know, and I'll kind of keep moving here, but it's interesting because it said 35%, you know, so we're saying about 1 in 3 Republicans say, you know, the state should not require this. The interesting thing about that is when we ask, you know, people about basically whether or not vaccines are safe or effective, we still find a majority of Republicans, you know, 50, not a huge majority, but 53% saying that they're entirely safe or mostly safe. We have a majority of Republicans, 56% saying they're entirely effective or mostly effective. Now, I should say, most of that is going to be in the mostly, not the entirely. But the point is just to say there's only about 1/4 of Republicans on both sides who think that vaccines are neither safe or effective. But there is this general sense overall, sort of the power of the political nature of it. There's a larger share who says, yeah, but we shouldn't require parents to do this. And sort of, to me, it's something interesting to watch going forward. Again, we saw the West Texas outbreak. We saw, the legislature sort of create more pathways to make this easier. We're seeing people use these pathways to avoid, you know, vaccinations. And what we're also seeing is this underlying political dynamic that I think we know from our own experience watching polling here was if you've got about 1/3 of Republicans who hold a pretty firm view on something, which is I think probably the, you know, I don't want to say anti-vaccination, but the vaccine skeptical crowd among Republicans is probably holds that view a little bit stronger, I think, than the share who are sort of, I would say, more, let's say, less vaccine skeptical. Let's just put it that, without being too, too judgmental. So this is an interesting thing to watch going forward, for me at least. It was one of those things we didn't really get a lot of time to talk about. And yet it was like, the outbreak's going on, they're tracking the numbers, we've got this data, but like there were just, there's only so much space sometimes to talk about these results. And this was
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good one. And, I think we talked about it a bit offline and then, couldn't quite get to it. And yeah, there's a lot more to do, but we'll move on. So, one of the things I mentioned that I kind of pulled out, and you and I talked about this, and this is kind of a more recent one that was in the October poll, I think, but we didn't get a chance to do much. And that was some items that we asked, and one in particular that I'll emphasize on First Amendment rights, particularly free speech rights. And look, these issues have been on the public agenda and a matter of public debate in, new ways. In some ways, they're not completely triggered by social media, for a while now, including in Texas. And these concerns about free speech rights have been evident in issues that are kind of across the political spectrum. Yeah. So there's it's a thing unto itself.
It's been a moving target a little bit.
But it's also, intersects a lot of other things that are going on. And it is one of the things that the data shows, and certainly just looking at the history of this, is that, these issues are making manifest across the political spectrum, but in different ways. So sort of from the right, conservatives have been arguing for, certainly another kind of pandemic rooted piece, or at least pandemic activated piece, that social media platforms systematically violated free speech rights over the last decade or so by, deploying deplatforming policies aimed at either curtailing what was thought of as hate speech or inaccurate public health information. That was really the kind of trigger during COVID. And then, going back further, again, widening the aperture, to use your metaphor, not to mention, the sort of larger accusations of institutionalized political correctness now sort of really manifesting as these anti-DEI policies being implemented at the state and national level. And Trump administration has taken the cause up with vigor, now. And again, by the cause, I don't mean the anti-DEI thing, although they have that, but this issue of, taking the high ground on defending speech rights. So among the big batch of first day back in office orders and statements issued by the White House on the very first day, one focused on the First Amendment and free speech rights. And it read in part, under the guise of, and this is a quote from the order, under the guise of combating quote-unquote misinformation, quote-unquote disinformation, and quote-unquote malinformation, which is one I don't think I've actually seen that much, the federal government infringed on the constitutionally protected speech rights of American citizens across the United States in a manner that advanced the governor's preferred narrative about significant matters of public debate. And I read that in verbatim.
Yeah, it's government, not governor at the end.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the government's preferred narrative. There. So
you read that verbatim.
That, it really kind of crystallized the intersection of this issue, I think, with government power. Now, from the left, the Trump administration's efforts to punish and arrest protesters, target entities like law firms, universities, and media companies, other examples, raised very similar and pronounced free speech concerns.
Right.
And it turns out, sort of when you ask a direct question about this a vector that we've seen a lot in terms of who is in control of government institutions has a lot to do with sort of partisan responses. So in the October poll, we asked a very direct question. How secure do you think the right to freedom of speech is in America today? Overall, pretty high level of concern. Only 7% said completely secure and 15% said very secure. Mm-hmm. 41%, the plurality, said not at all secure.
Right.
So then when you look at the partisan structure, again, you see this, increasingly important, partisan response to who's in control of political institutions in the state, at least in part inflecting partisan response in the state and at the national level. So Republicans much more likely to say speech rights were either completely or very secure, total of 39% for those two categories, though the the very was much bigger than the completely. But the plurality said that, you know, they were only somewhat secure, joined by 18% who said not at all secure, right? So, you know, Republicans not as worried. Right.
Well, which, but I mean, just to put a pause on that for one thing, which is interesting, right? Given the point that this has been an issue taken up with such vigor at so many levels, that this is a threat that needs to be addressed. But when now, and I will say, this is sort of a this is one of the tricky parts, sort of polling chickens, eggs, causal arrows, whatever. You know, is it the vigor with which the administration has taken it up that has then reduced sort of concern that was there,
right?
That we're not measuring right at this point in time, and this is therefore a reflection of that, or is it the case that actually underlying this, there's just not that much concern.
Right. And you know, unfortunately, we don't have like a pre-post Trump administration.
Right.
You know, so, yeah. And just to summarize that again, I mean, for Republicans, so, you know, 39% said completely or very secure. 39% said somewhat secure. Only 18% said not at all.
Just right.
So Democrats, not surprisingly, convey more worry. Only 6% said free speech was completely or very secure, while a clear majority, no pluralities here.
Right.
64% said not at all secure, joined by another 28% who said somewhat secure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, I think timing is probably has a little bit to do there. Now, interestingly, independents looked much more like Democrats. And if we were to break responses down by ideology, moderates looked much more like liberals than conservatives. So there is a lot of structure here. And I think, you know, we'll have to keep answering, you know, we'll probably be asking this question a little more frequently going forward.
It's a really interesting, you know, it's a really interesting area. And we asked something else within this battery about, you know, the comfort that people have expressing their political views in different settings. And we don't need to go through all those data points here, I don't think, unless we want to. But I think the main, you know, sort of takeaway from that that was pretty interesting was that, you know, whereas in that other question, you're talking about the sort of abstract idea and, you know, you'd and I think, you know, you laid that out, you'd expect this to respond to who's in control of political power and what they're doing with it and all that kind of stuff. But when we ask the other question about, well, yeah, but you expressing your political views, you know, at work, around, you know, in public settings, on social media, around friends, the interesting thing—
Friends, family.
Extended family, close friends, you know, immediate family. And the interesting thing about those results was despite, you know, the vigor with which the Trump administration has taken this up, the vigor with which, you know, these sort of accusations have been lobbed at the left for silencing conservative voices, the polling found actually that the Republicans and conservatives were significantly more comfortable expressing their political views than were Democrats and liberals. And that was true across the settings, right? It was about, it seemed like about at least a 10 point gap in most cases in terms of the level of comfort between the two groups. And so just to say, I mean, that to me, I'm just sort of pointing that out because one, I think this is the whole point of this podcast, like pretty interesting, you know, just given the whole rhetoric and the context. But what it also sort of says is this is another one of those things where, you know, either, you know, we're uncovering something here that's durable and is something that's going to need to kind of continue to sort of be mined and sort of figured out, because if this is the case, you know, there's going to be a counter to this at some point, or this is just all very malleable.
Right.
You know, if we had asked this question during the Biden administration, would we have seen Republicans, you know, 80% saying, hey, this is not secure. Oh, I can't express anything anywhere. Or what?
Yeah.
And we don't know. I mean, that's part of the problem. Is
well, the problem challenge. Is, I think part of the problem is that there's, you know, there's so many different dimensions to this that we really do need more data for, as you've kind of pointed out. Just to kind of, you know, there's the partisan dimension. There's the, and then there's the, you know, who's in control of institutions dimension. And then there's kind of an elite, non-elite dimension here.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Well, I can't help.
You know, what people that aren't, you know, immersed in the media sphere or, you know, professional and professional adjacent politics, you know, how much attention do you pay? You know, who's feeling this and for what reason is still not clear. But there's clearly kind of something going on with, you know, the sense of insecurity.
Yeah, and you know what we're missing in this question probably most is some kind of attempt to get at the extent to which someone does generally engage in like discussions of politics.
Yeah,
because I mean that's a huge piece of this, right? I mean, we know that most people are not posting political things on social media, full stop. Right, regardless of whether they feel comfortable.
Yeah, I mean,
or not.
We could probably add you know, how often would you say you discuss politics?
Right.
with, you know, family or friends or, you know.
Right.
Or
I mean, there's a bunch of interesting stuff we could pull back, you know, make some sausage in here right now. But it would be interesting to sort of look at that and see the extent to which, you know, among different groups, those attitudes are, you know, co-vary or not. So the idea is you do it a lot and you're comfortable. It would be something you'd expect. The question is who does it a lot and isn't comfortable or who. And part of it, I think, is not just about doing it, it's wanting to do it. Like, do you want to have these discussions in some ways?
Yeah, too? I mean, that's, you know, it's very complicated. I was saying that, I was like, well, there's a, you know.
Yeah.
Where, when, why, you know.
Right.
Well, you know, and I'm sure there's more out there that.
In some ways, this is a good example of why we never got to this in one of the podcasts, you know, during much of the year, because this is a big discussion. It raises a lot of issues.
Well,
a lot of
and I think even, you know, and also even further before that, why, and I, you know, maybe I'm making this up. I could actually be confusing the class with the poll a little bit. I don't think so. But, you know, it's hard to just ask one or two questions about this, about civil liberties topics. It's almost like, okay, you need to do a civil liberties poll or, you know, a First Amendment poll. Or, dig at it.
And part of this, and then I think let's wrap this and maybe we'll move on, is, you know, part of the reason for that, what we're trying to get at is, like, first of all, it's obviously a high dimensionality issue. We're talking about this general idea, and then there's this idea of, like, you express your political views. There's these different contexts in which you can do it. There's a question of whether you regularly want to do that and feel like you can. Yeah. So all these things. And so ultimately, that is the point why it needs a lot more. Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. So what else you got?
All right, let's move back to maybe more, a little more to the state level. So, you know, another, you know, of the most seemingly persistent issues, of course, is property taxes.
I think we could even cut the seemingly.
Yeah, no, I'm being too generous maybe. Okay.
Well, no, look, no. There's a dimensionality issue here in terms of, you know, the part of the point that, not to... No. Spoiler alert, but, you know, elite versus popular concern.
No, that's right. So yeah, I mean, look, on the one hand, you know, the legislature has done a ton on this issue, right? So the homestead exemption has raised from $15,000 back in 2015, if you don't remember, to $140,000 after the most recent constitutional amendment election. Now, on the other hand, as anyone who has listened to this podcast for any period of time knows, voters have consistently expressed concerns over the overall cost of living, the cost of housing, which is something that the legislature really has limited power to impact, you know, significantly on their own, especially while maintaining limited government, you know, interventions. But the public has prioritized these issues, you know, sort of throughout the legislative session, right? They were worried about housing, worried about property taxes. And the challenge, and this is one of those sort of, again, interesting polling nuggets that we tend to find really over and over again, is that voters tend either, you know, not to notice these efforts, right, whether on their tax bills or due to a lack of attention, or to even, like, really appreciate them when they get divided up over, you know, 12 monthly mortgage payments.
And right, without going back into it, We've tested that specific proposition by, you know, asking people about how much the projected average amount of impact would impact them, et cetera.
Or impact other people or whatever. And it's always like, not really. So, you know, even though the legislature has increased the homestead exemption by more than, you know, $110,000 already when we asked this question in February, and this is what I'm looking at first, you know, one of the things we asked was, you know, what is the impact that Texans receive of these efforts by the legislature over the last number of years to decrease their property taxes?
And just to reemphasize, this was in February as we were assessing, you know, discussion to come of property taxes that had been signaled by everyone at the leadership level was going to happen.
Right. And as we recall, in the session before this one, they also
made,
you know, pretty significant efforts to reduce property tax. So we asked, we said, okay, you know, have these efforts had a major impact, a minor impact, again, on your personal finances? No impact. Well, overall, a quarter of Texans, 25%, said this had a major impact. 35%, a minor impact. 27%, no impact. 13% just said, I don't know. Right. So overall, if you take the no impact and don't know, you know, with 40% of Texans, 35% say minor impact, 25% say major. And if you kind of keep track of these things, so that's $50 billion, I think, in each biennial budget to cover these. And the voters are like, still expensive. And the problem is, when we ask people about the different types of taxes they pay, and again, we know there's been a lot of movement here. In February 2023, 41% of Texans said that, I'm sorry, no, 58% of Texans in 2023 in February 2023, said that property taxes have a major impact on their personal finances. So it's a big problem. They increased the homestead exemption before 2025. In 2025, we asked that question again. 68% say it's a major impact on their finances. So it didn't go down. It went up by 10 points, which is pretty significant. Taxes, the impact of taxes went up pretty much across the board on the sales tax, property tax, less so on the other taxes because fewer people
pay
them.
But it even went up with gas.
With gas. Now, part of that is going to be the other side, inflation, other kinds of things, kind of putting pressures.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, to the point you made earlier, I mean, as the broader context. Mm-hmm. I mean, and we did talk about this a little bit at the time, I think. You know, but we talked about it from the perspective of the centrality of people's feelings of economic pressure and, in particular, day-to-day cost of living sensitivity.
Well, and this is, you know, sort of getting us, you know, a little bit into the looking ahead piece, right? But the issue is this question about, you know, whether the concept of affordability, I put that in quotes for everybody here, is a real concept or not, is a made-up word or not. You get it if you get it. But the point is that that's all reflecting to real polling data that we've actually talked a ton about in here about economic concerns. And you can see that, you know, the governor is stirring here going into 2026, right? He's talking about eliminating some or all property taxes. And you've got, you know, which obviously generated a pretty cool reception from the lieutenant governor, you know, who would like actually be forced to, you know, do it and make it happen.
Yeah, I'd say you could say cold.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know.
You know, in some ways, actually hot.
Yeah. Well, you know, we talked about this, you know, be brief, but there is sort of a sense, you know, going back over their relationship where, like, you know, this is a pretty good move for Abbott. He's done this before where he can say, I'm going to take this position. It's the, you know, it's the most conservative position and it may not be possible, but ultimately it's not up to him to do it. And so when the legislature comes back, goes, well, it's like, what kind of hole would we have to fill to get rid of property tax? And it's like, well, what are we going to do? How do we do that? And the answer is we can't. And then for Abbott, you get to say, well, I tried. You know, the legislature couldn't do it. I want to get rid of property tax. And he's already been kind of roadshowing this. And the only cost of it is that it pisses off the lieutenant governor, rightly so. But, you know, in the end of the day, he gets the benefit for you know, quote unquote, trying. Right. And but the point is, I think for overall, he's responding to something that's very real. And something else to just point out here, and I didn't put this data in, but we talked about it before. It's not like Democrats don't want a tax cut. Independents want a tax cut. Everybody, this is something that's, you know, it really puts, you know, Democrats in the tough position because when they campaign, even though, you know, they may like think this is a crazy plan or they'd say, well, what is, you know, again, this in pure politics, it's a two sentence problem. He says, I want to get rid of property taxes. And then Democrats say, well, how are we going to pay for X, Y, and Z? And it's like, you've already kind of lost here. And are you saying you're for higher property taxes?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know
it changes the terrain.
Well, if that's your objection, then what's your alternative?
Exactly.
You know, and there's a, you know, it's essentially a trap.
It is a trap, but it's a well-laid trap.
It's a trap, you know, in bipartisan general election politics.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So that's one that just, it's just still out there. And I mean, part of it for all of us is like, you know, is anything going to change this dynamic? And I mean, it's interesting because from a policy standpoint, when you look at sort of where the legislature almost fell off the rails during the special session over the tax rate elections and stuff like that, you know, this isn't something that's like going to go anywhere anytime soon, but it's actually getting harder and harder to deal with. And the voters aren't rewarding anybody for it.
Right. And continuing to raise the issue.
Right.
Without an end game.
Yeah.
Now, look, we'll come back to this in January, I think, but, you know. I mean, I think the arc of the political careers of the most vocal participants in this at the elected official level means that, you know, worrying about the end game, not to be cynical, is not really their problem.
Right. Yeah.
Which, you know, from a policy and institutional perspective, you know, I'm shrugging.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, speaking of, you know, I'll move on to the next one.
Yeah, what's the next one?
We'll stick with state politics and the legislature. So something we didn't talk about very much, I don't think, or maybe we only mentioned it glancingly, I think, in one of the podcasts after the the June poll is that, you know, in the little interregnum between the regular session and the special sessions that followed it in our June poll.
Mm-hmm.
We asked the question that we've asked in this slot a couple of times before, and this is where we get a little into trend stuff, you know, away from, but still kind of nuggety. So the question was phrased as follows. As you probably know, the Texas legislature recently concluded its regular session. Based on what you've heard, do you think the legislature made the lives of Texans like you better, made the lives of Texans like you worse, or had no impact on the lives of Texans like you? Now, the reason I included this in there is that there's, you know, bare minimum, three sessions.
Yeah.
But something of a trend, and it's going in a way that's sort of not very good for the legislature, frankly.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, the issue here is, you know, so in June of 2025, 19% said that the legislature made their lives a lot better.
3% a lot better.
I'm sorry, 3% said made a lot better. 19% said made somewhat better. And then on the negative side, 21% said they had made it somewhat worse, 16% a lot worse. So basically 22-37, with, you know, again, understandable given the place of state politics and the state legislature, you know, 22% saying they don't know, and, you know, in a different vein, 19% saying no impact. Now, the change over time is pretty clear in that the share that said a lot better in June of 2021, or that this said better, you know, combination lot better, somewhat better, was 34% in June of 2021 after that session, down to 27% in June of 2023, and then down to 22% in June of 2025. Moving in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
So to the degree that we talk a lot about, and there's a lot of things that could, you know, I don't want to overplay this, as, you know, the context here is important, but it's not like in June of 2021, midst of the pandemic, coming out of it, you know, things were great.
Yeah.
Or, you know, people were, you know, you could say that people were in a particularly, you know, positive mood about institutions.
Yeah.
So the decline there, I think, is pretty interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, it's easy to look at 21 where you've got 34 saying better, 35 saying worse, and, you know, about equal share saying better and worse in June, with the remainder either saying no impact or don't know. And part of that is partisan structure, right? To some extent, you can kind of say, okay, that's a lot of people kind of canceling each other out. But part of the reason we ask that question is, you know, to almost look and say, well, you know, this is a Republican dominated body. They have control of everything. And a lot of this is also looking among the Republicans at this. What's interesting here is that when you jump ahead to 2025 and it drops down to 22%, the idea that, you know, like in the neighborhood of 1 in 5 voters can say the legislature made their lives better when they were asking them for, I mean, and honestly, and we'll kind of come to this in the next one.
Yeah, from 1 in 3.
From 1 in 3 and down to 1 in 5.
Four years earlier.
And what are they asking for? You know, they're not necessarily, based on the polling data, and we just can bring this in, they're not asking for, you know, whatever, free cars or, you know, Teslas for, I mean, like literally it's like reliable electric grid. Reliable water supply,
yeah.
Lower cost of living,
housing. The things that people are telling us are important.
Yeah, and so that's the thing that's sort of interesting. And I think it's, you know, some other data that we could have potentially done in this particular podcast, but I think attaches to this is, you know, we noticed throughout the entirety of the year the decline in job approvals amongst pretty much every statewide leader. The other one that we thought about talking about was we have a question about the Texas model of government and whether it's a good model for other states to follow. Historically, Texans will say, yes, Texas model is what other states should follow. This was the first year in which we saw that underwater.
Yeah.
And so this is all part of, you know, in some ways I feel like I'm, you know, I feel, I don't want to say like Chicken Little, because I don't think I'm ever saying the sky is falling or anything, but there is a part of me sometimes which we're doing this, we get the data back, oh, that's negative. I guess we'll tell people it's negative again.
Yeah.
But like you look at the whole year and you say, yeah, it's because like it is, and you see it, and we talk about, you know, it's internally consistent.
Right.
We see it across in these different ways we can look at it. And this one I think is a great one to pull out, because this is just where the rubber meets the road. Did the people in power make your lives better?
Yeah.
And very few Texans can say that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it just intersects. And again, it's not definitive.
No.
And that's why I kind of pulled it out in a kind of nuggety sort of sense is that, but it's an interesting part of several discussions about, you know, this short to medium term trend that we've seen over the last year, in terms of the overall decline in job approval ratings and all this, and the kind of, for lack of a better term, called, you know, sort of the dour mood of the state.
Yeah, wrong track, right direction,
all
that stuff.
Yeah, you know, the Texas model and all that. But, you know, also, you know, we've talked a lot about going into the campaign. And, you know, we've now talked about it for the last couple of statewide campaigns, certainly the last one and this one. You know, that there is, you know, in the partisan universe that we're in, you know, without trying to, you know, pick on anybody. I mean, one party sort of owns what's going on politically, policy-wise, institution. You know, Republicans have been running state government for, you know, almost 3 decades now, essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, these numbers, you know, tend to be part of that story.
Yeah.
And, you know, from one side you can say, you know, from one perspective anyway, you could say, look, this tells us that, you know, they're wearing out their welcome, or, you know, and I wouldn't quite go that far.
I don't go that far either.
You know, I don't think that makes sense. But it, on the other hand, you know, there is something to say that, you know, if you're going to talk about accountability, you're going to try to talk about policy ownership, and performance and accountability and response, you know, all those big concepts, again, from the 310 course.
Right.
You know, there's something kind of going on here that makes you raise questions about what is going on in the political system right now. You know, because we're, you know, I mean, I think, you know, your desire to not be, you know, your reference to not being Chicken Little, I'm somewhat hedging and saying, I'm not saying this means that they're losing the public relations war, that, you know, but, you know, there is something going on here in which coming into an election, you have to think about how people are viewing ownership of the organs of government, and particularly, to go back to our earlier themes, at a time when the Republican Party is embracing a model of using government to act more decisively and in a more, you know, frankly, kind of interventionist way.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think what's interesting is, you know, I mean, I like their whole, you know, would you say they're out wearing their welcome? It's like, no, I mean, because part of the thing you have to acknowledge here is that I think a lot of the data that we see, and we're not going to go into this. I mean, and again, we've talked about some of this stuff before and whatever, so I'm not going to lay all this out. It's another time. But a lot of the challenges that Republicans are facing, bear with me. Let me back up for 1 second. You look at this and you say, why can't Democrats just say, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, and make that the whole campaign? I think that's like the first thing that I think a basic read of this would say, and it seems very valid. The problem is this, is that Republicans' challenges have come from their successes more than from something else, in the sense that, you know, by having control of the state government, by having the kind of majorities they've had to do a lot more coalition management than, you know, I think on balance, than I think would sort of probably address the median voter in the electorate, right, or whatever. And that's easy enough to say, right? And I think that's kind of the piece of this. And so you have to remember that even though these things may be going on, it's because they have a majority of the voters that they're trying to satisfy, and they're making choices where sometimes it is a 65-35 issue within the party.
Right. It's a sign. Yeah. I mean, look, it's a sign of your superior position if this is your problem.
Right. Exactly. Right?
This is potentially a
exactly.
problem. Exactly. Okay. So let's move on. What else you got?
Okay. You know, I just moving really up to the present. I mean, I was sort of going through the data and I really could not help but notice, you know, how much healthcare was popping up in different places. It's not because we were asking directly about healthcare a bunch. It's because we'd have batteries of items with a bunch of different issues, and healthcare would be one of those issues. And it was just notable throughout the year how much it has come up. And I raise it, obviously, for anyone who knows, who's watching this or listening to this, is because obviously right now healthcare costs and subsidies is a big issue. Republicans are trying to come up with some sort of a replacement for the Affordable Care Act subsidies that were expanded during the COVID pandemic that are now obviously lapsing. This is a big issue. People are talking about a huge issue in Texas.
It's a raw nerve that's being hit right now in
And I think one of the
live debates.
And I think one of the things about going back over the year is you sort of go, oh, this was always here. Now, we know this is always here as pollsters. In some sense, there's always a share of the public for whom healthcare is like front of mind, and it never goes away. And we can talk about that another time. But going over just the course of the year, and I'll do this really quickly, you know, in February we asked people, you know, what the legislature should prioritize, or how important different priorities were for the legislature based on the discussions that were going on and open-ended questions we have. And increasing access to healthcare, 47% of Texans said that was extremely important. Another 27% said very important. Trailed only lowering the cost of everyday goods and services and improving the reliability of the state's energy grid, which we've talked about here as a persistent sore spot for people after those. I'll keep going. In April, we asked about state spending levels and whether the state spends too much, too little, or the right amount on different areas. At the top of that list, in terms of where we spend too little, mental health services, 59% of Texans says we spend too little there. Healthcare was 57%. And so those were pretty much at or near the top for every group of voters, healthcare, mental health services, where the state was spending too little. In August, we asked about the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and the extent to which it would have an impact on healthcare costs, because that was one of the discussions at the time. And when we asked about that, 44% of Texans, a plurality, said they expected this to increase their healthcare costs. 21% expected it to have no impact. 25% didn't know. But even here, 79% of Democrats said they thought it would increase their healthcare costs. 48% of independents said it would increase their healthcare costs. And among Republicans, the plurality, 36% said no impact. 31% said they didn't know. And so that was floating around there then. And then, as we've talked about many times, we asked about various economic concerns. And outside of the price of food and consumer goods, which always shows the highest level and the most intense level of concern, the cost of healthcare is barely barely less.
Right.
And so if we go back and just look at, you know, the share of Texans over the course of the year who said, you know, the price of food, which is what we're talking about, the price of food and consumer goods, is that they're very concerned about over the course of the year, the share of Texans was 73% were very concerned about the cost of food and consumer goods, then 63, 60, 64. And then for cost of or health care, it's been 68, 62, 61, 63, and 66% back in October, which probably gone up given what's gone on now. Yeah, the table's a little off on the thing.
Yeah, yeah, it's fine.
And so this is something where 2/3 of Texans say they are very concerned about the cost of healthcare. It's another 22% say they're somewhat concerned. Add that up, that's 88%. There's a reason this is like a huge issue.
Yeah.
You say like, hey, is this partisan? Is this just Democrats, you know, wringing their hands or whatever? And it's like, well, 51% of Republicans are very concerned about the cost of healthcare. Another 29% somewhat concerned. Add that up, that's 80%, right? And very importantly for, I think, looking ahead into 2026 and thinking about these elections, 73% of African Americans, 71% of Hispanic Texans very concerned about the cost of healthcare. So this is not some new issue. This is not some surprise. If you've been looking at the point, like this has been here. They've said, people have said they're concerned about this. They want the legislature to spend more, create more access. They thought that the One Big Beautiful Bill Act might actually decrease, you know, or increase their healthcare costs. They've been concerned about healthcare costs. So like, there's a reason the Democrats are like, let's keep talking about this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's an interesting, in between the August and, you know, this, you know, this, the, mm-hmm. tick up again in October. I was giving a talk for a trade group. I don't remember exactly. Actually, probably a version of a talk I gave a couple times in, you know, September or so. I kept saying when people were asked, you know, one of the things I kind of pointed out and trying to do some value add and a little point things out was, you know, health, you know, watch healthcare.
Yeah.
Because it does seem like, you know, and this has been, it's interesting over even the longer run. We've talked about this before where, you know, healthcare is always in one of those issues that moves the needle some in the more general, like most important problem, batteries and things like that.
Yeah.
But it's been a while since it, you know, in the life of the poll, since it was front and center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in some ways has never been at the top of the list
right. That
I can recall.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But it's also not gone away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there's
you know, and it's another thing where the price sensitivity now and the economic concerns now, I think, are really catalyzing this.
Yeah. I think that's
in conjunction with the policy intersection.
And that's like that's right on the nose. I was thinking about this morning and why this is the case. And you think about some of the discussions we've had about like, you know, the price of eggs or the price of gasoline. We talk on this podcast all the time about why that's so salient to people because they go to the grocery stores because they fill their tanks with gas. But ultimately, if the price of eggs go up and you buy a lot of eggs, you know, maybe that affects your grocery bill by, I don't know, 10, 20 bucks, like on the high end, you know, if you buy a lot of eggs over the course of a month, right?
Right.
But like healthcare costs are in the hundreds and thousands of dollars, right?
Yeah, yeah. Particularly if you're getting trouble.
Yeah.
I mean,
in general.
And your health insurance, but your health insurance costs, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm using that in the broadest sense, right? Whether you're talking about your premiums or your co-pays. Or, you know, whatever, you know, all these things are not, you know, the sort of like, well, that's an extra $30 expense or that increases my grocery bill by 3% on the month. So I can make some adjustments to that. Because that's the other piece, that you can't make adjustments on a lot of these issues.
Yeah.
And so this is where, you know, it is something that I think, you know, it's not surprising that we're talking, you know, I'm just saying, if you think about what we're talking about here, we didn't talk about prices and cost of living, which we talk about all the time, which is why we didn't talk about
it. Yeah, that's why it didn't come up here.
But that's why it's like, but what did we talk about? It's like, well, property taxes, because that relates to another big price concern, which is housing, which again is something where the difference is usually in the hundreds of dollars at least, if not
things
thousands.
Things with large price tags.
Yeah. And again, I'll raise this because I think it's just a really interesting piece of data that people should be aware of, which is, you know, when you ask Americans whether or not they can cover a $400 expense, usually about a third at least say no. When you say like a $1,000 expense, it goes above a majority. So when you're talking about these things that are in the hundreds of dollars per month or the thousands of dollars one time or per month, like there's most, you know, flip a coin, most likely whoever you're talking about can't handle that.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that they can shave off or adjust to make that happen. And so when you say, why is this such a big issue and why is it expanding in its sort of presence? I think this is why, because normally that persistent, you know, sort of 5-10% of people, that makes perfect sense to anybody who like studies healthcare economics. And like, there's like 5% of the healthcare population that generates like something like some exorbitant amount of the total healthcare costs because they're chronically ill, which is always the challenge with all this. So it makes sense that there's going to be some small share of people who are always concerned about healthcare, right? Yeah. And the people who are close to those people. But this is where you're kind of like, this is extending beyond that, because this is not about people who are dealing with chronic health conditions. This is like anything that comes up at this point for certain people in this economy, and given what we know about people's finances, is going to be a huge challenge.
Yeah.
And to the extent that one party in this case is seen as not addressing that challenge, that's a liability. And if anything, if they're making it worse, that's a huge liability.
And I think you're seeing that in practice in the,
yeah.
you know, in the congressional debate going on mm-hmm, right
exactly.
now. It's, you know, the, you know, you're seeing, you know, growing Republican defections from the way that you characterized
yeah.
it by members of Congress, and even in a couple of cases, maybe senators that are in swing states.
Mm-hmm. There's unease.
Right,
with
where,
the
where they are more, or, you know, that are in swing states or swing districts, where they are in competitive districts, mm-hmm. and they are more exposed to something that is clearly there.
Yeah.
Right. In a very common sense kind of, you know, we got to do this.
Yeah.
Right. We can't, if we ignore this in my, if I ignore this in my position, I am going to pay.
Right.
And yeah. I think that that's kind of the operationalization of that. Of,
right.
You know, what you're describing. So, you know, anything else you want to add? I think we're in pretty good shape here.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously, there's always, you know, there's always
yeah, there's
more.
There's a lot more.
There's always more. There's other stuff we could talk about. I mean, for sure. But, you know, I think this, I feel good about this. Just in, this, you know, in terms of a little bit of cleanup that we didn't get to do over the course of the year, want to talk about some of these topics a little bit more. I think, you know, one of the other big themes of this podcast has been the nationalization of politics, and has certainly been, you know, whenever obviously Trump is in office, he is a major theme of the podcast. And so I think, you know, under our own time constraints, we've definitely focused more on kind of the national stuff a little bit sometimes, maybe.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to kind of jump back in and even look at some of these, even the national stuff we looked at here is almost in a big picture, kind of still useful at the state level understanding. It's nice to go back and remind ourselves like, hey, why are we still talking about property taxes?
Yeah.
Didn't we just, I thought we just solved that. We just voted on it, you know? Well, here's why. I mean, you know, and some of this other stuff. So I'm pretty pleased with the little
yeah, I mean,
there.
I think it sets the stage in a good way for, you know, what we're seeing coming up. I mean, mm-hmm. we had some other things we thought about talking about here that also talks about the content of that nationalization of politics.
Yeah.
But the themes have come up. I think some of them indirectly here. You know, concerns about the operation of institutions in the political system.
Mm-hmm.
Get a little taste of that, I think, in the free speech, in the speech rights thing.
Yeah.
And then just, you know, how the parties are going to position themselves
mm-hmm.
as we go into this national election. And, you know, I mean, I think the, you know, property tax and healthcare are two interesting ways of saying, you know, what is the, you know, what is the, what's the coefficient going to be of these kind of organic state level issues?
Right.
And of these more national forces that are
right.
coming out. And as
yeah.
we talked about this a lot. We don't need to revisit it, I think, completely, because it's kind of the theme either last week or the week before.
Mm.
But I mean, I think all the data we've talked about, understand just how complicated those two,
yeah.
broadly speaking, directional forces are,
mm-hmm.
mediated by something that is going to be out of the control of any of these candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where the economy goes. And how voters are understanding that and
yeah.
experiencing that. I mean, I think your description of the healthcare stuff really captures that mm-hmm. well, but, you know, as does all the talk about property tax bills. So with that, thanks for all the work you put into this,
yeah.
all the work this year.
My pleasure.
Congratulations on launching the class.
It's great.
And we're almost done. Great, you know, sit down and figure out some grades after this.
Yeah.
And thanks again, as always, for a year of excellent work from the production team here in the Liberal Arts Development Studio at UT Austin, group of both young professionals and budding professional students. You guys do a great job. Most of all, thanks to all of you for listening. As always, all the results and more are here at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And, you know, we like to hear from you. One of the artifacts of being so busy with the class is that we've been a little bit quiet on our email list as well, hoping to get that geared up with a little more frequency, but not too much. It's a thing right now that people are getting too much list email. So we'll try to continue to be prudent.
Well, we actually write ours.
But
so
valuable
it takes some time.
In that. And so thanks to you all a lot for listening. And we'll be back early next year with another second reading podcast and some new polling data. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.